Senate Committee on Health Policy and Public Affairs to order on this rainy day of March 7th, 2007. Welcome, committee, and members in the, not the congregation, but the...
Well, they are congregants. And there's a preacher back there.
Any announcements at this point? No. Okay, I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 604. And Senator Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Chair. My name is David Nelson, State Senator from Pelton. I represent four counties, Umatilla, Morrow, Union, and Loudoun County. And Senate Bill 604 is being brought to us in Pelton. We have a...
Good morning.
Organization called Pelton Academies. It's the only psychiatric residential treatment program offering a day treatment program. These children here are referred to the Pelton Academies by state and local agencies. They actually serve statewide. They are giving you a handout, I believe. You can look in the back where they've come up with literally over 800 people and throughout the state. So they do take people. This is a statewide situation, and I think everybody in this committee is pretty much aware of the issues and the problems that we're having with providing access to mental care, and particularly for some of these young people. And Pelton seems to have one of the few places out there in our part of the country that has a working, effective kid program. There's also some facts and figures that I'm sure they'll show to you that indicate the effectiveness of this program. Not only do they give access for service, but they do it at a very reasonable cost. We're talking about some things in this session, the Governor's Healthy Kids Plan, and if that should happen to pass, it's going to take some time for that to get going. This is a program that's on the ground and is working, and it does a great job, has a great amount of success. I've toured this Pelton Academies on many occasions, and their staff is very professional. They bring in psychiatrists and foremen, fly them in. I mean, it's a great opportunity for our community and for the surrounding area to have access to some really high-quality care that does some good. And so I would be asking for your support of the mental health day treatment for children by supporting Senate Bill 604. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning, members. Thank you for the opportunity to be here and to testify on Senate Bill 604. I certainly am not going to try to get into all of the specifics. I know the staff folks from Pendleton are here. They'll be able to answer and deal with a lot of your questions and a lot of your concerns that you might have. But my purpose for being here this morning is to encourage you to consider this Senate bill and to move it forward. This gets at a issue that is very near and dear to my heart, as I know it is to you all, and that is our young people, and particularly our young people who suffer from mental, emotional disturbances that make it extremely difficult, if not impossible, for them to be in the mainstream, if that's the right word, of the growing up process, that they need extra special help and care. And one of the really shortages I think that we have that this bill is helping or would help address, at least for us in eastern Oregon, is what I would call a day treatment component of the facility. While they have beds and they have 24 hours for some of the extremely severely disturbed, they also have and are instituting a day treatment type program where young people can come in, be there for the day. They receive the psychiatric social work type of treatment that is needed, in addition to which they will be part of the education will be provided there in the facility for them, so that while they're going through trying and difficult times, they're not held up in their educational process, that they're able to move along. This is truly and I can speak to this from a firsthand sort of background on it, that this is truly one of the effective programs, you know, in the state and maybe in the country as far as dealing with this particular group and category of children. My only real plea would be that statewide we could have more facilities of this type, so that no young person is going to get lost in the cracks simply because they have a mental illness type problem that other children by accident of birth or whatever have not had to bear. And so I urge you to look carefully at this and to move it forward. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Try to answer any questions that you, the committee, would have.
May I speak?
Yes, please.
Yes, thank you again. Again, David Nelson, State Senator from Pendleton. There's going to be opposition to this bill, and you're going to hear about that. But at some point, I think what we as legislators are going to have to figure out what's working, and are we going to create a whole new program or allow or centralized control, try and dictate how we're operating in our parts of the country? I mean, this is a program that works. You know, put some trust back in the community level. Allow these people to continue their good work. Give them their opportunity. I mean, they have everything in place. They have a great campus, a great facility. They've got horses out there. And I mean, it's TPEs. I mean, they really do a great job with these kids to keep them out of trouble, to make them productive citizens. So let's do things that work. I mean, that's what we're supposed to be doing here. And so, I know there's going to be opposition to this bill, but I hope that the committee will say, okay, let's do the right thing here. Let's fund this program, keep this program going, make it even better than it already is.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Oh. Did you wish to continue?
As Senator Reese spoke, I was reminded that I didn't introduce myself, and it is State Representative Bob Jensen from Pendleton.
Is he one of the freshmen here?
A freshman move. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say good morning to both of our colleagues, and thank you both for bringing the measure forward. And I also want to encourage your participation in the newly formed Mental Health Caucus, which is meeting tomorrow, Thursday, and every other Thursday from 8 to 9 in room 343. That Mental Health Caucus is open to every legislator in this building. It's open to advocates and all who are concerned about the reforms that we must address in this session. I want to thank Bob Junedep, who's sitting in the back of the room, who serves as co-chair with me of the Mental Health Caucus. Bob is with the Oregon Advocacy Center. And again, I just want to extend this invitation to both of you and to my colleagues on the committee as well to participate in that caucus, because it's going to help us further refine the choices and the decisions that we need to make in this session, that we must make in this session, and we need your help doing that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions? Yes, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment, and I am one of the sponsors of the bill, and just a comment would be there are other day treatment programs in the state that are also incredibly critical, and so I'm hoping that the agencies will be mindful of the whole system when they're dealing with the issue.
Mm-hmm. I've been part of an interim task force looking at community-based psychiatric care, and it's still in the works, and so we'll see what the outcome from that also. I think that we have to look at it as a whole.
I mean, just a call, if I could, Chair. I think, you know, the mental health situation, building the new buildings, it's more than just brick and mortars. It's it's the community-based programs that really help solve the problem on a case-by-case basis. And Pelton Academies is doing that. I know there's some very good programs throughout the state that we ought to be looking at, too. So thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Carter.
The one thing I think is important for all of us to know, even if the state wanted to, it could not do all the work that is necessary in this particular area. And so in my time here, we've striven very hard, and I know I will not accept it no other way, to make sure community partnerships were a reality, because Oregon as a society needs to help take care of its kids and its people who are as vulnerable as the people that we are talking about here. So even if there is opposition, Senator, the one thing I've noticed about this chair, she makes people work together, and that's exactly my style as well. So I'm hoping all of us will remain confident in our system, that we're going to try to do all we can to make sure that all of our partners are up to the standard that we want to see in this state, but also are a part of helping to take care of our most vulnerable.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you. And, Madam Chair, if I might address Senator Cordley's comments about the Mental Health Caucus. Schedule does not permit me to be there, but I have assigned Evelyn, if that's all right, with the chair, my wife, to be there. And she's probably eminently more qualified in that arena than I am anyway, so...
We'll look forward to seeing her, and thank you. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, I'd like to call, thank you very much, Senator and Representative. I'd like to call Mary Moore, and is it Dr. David Connaught? Pardon?
Konitz Norville.
Konitz.
Another one of those hyphenated.
Konitz Norville. Hmm.
Good morning. Good morning, Senator Mona Sanderson, Senators and Representatives. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of the children of Eastern Oregon. I'm Mary Moore Seaver. I'm the Executive Director of Pendleton Academies. We're a JCO-accredited psychiatric treatment center for providing hospital-level care for children ages 5 through 17. Currently, every year, we are serving over 200 children suffering from emotional and behavioral problems. About 80% of our kids have been traumatized, abused, neglected. Another 80%, a lot of comorbidity, have inherited genetic disorders. At Pendleton Academies, we help our kids resolve their traumas, overcome their difficulties, and succeed in our program. We are all a dedicated group of people, and we are very invested in our program. I've been with the program for 13 years, and I just love what we've done, and it's a good way to live my life, devoting myself to kids. We're very efficient. We have the shortest length of stay record in Oregon for the last 6 years. We're very effective. 78% of our children remain after 1 year after discharge, free of legal charges, at home, and in school or working. That's a really great success record. And we do that. We keep national statistics, and according to those, we're also one of the best in the nation regarding improvements in overall condition, and low rates of restraint, seclusion. We don't need to do that very often at our center. It's because of our model that we experience so much success. It's an exceptional model. It's a medical model. We have 3 child psychiatrists that review our children every week. We have a pediatrician that visits every week. And we have a nurse practitioner. Together, that medical team provides a lot of care to our kids that, in a team type of effort, and actually with the children personally. So this isn't a consultant type of situation. They come in, they know our kids. We have a normative setting. We clinically treat our children in least restrictive setting possible. So whenever possible, our kids are in a home setting. They're a therapeutic family, but if to the kid, it's a house and a family that they're living in. They go to school. Yes, it is a special school. It's structured with a lot of adults, and a lot of it's individualized, a lot of specialization. But to the kid, it's school. And they practice being a normal, regular kid in the community so that when they finally leave us, they are very well versed in what they should be doing, and they're rewarded for it, and it feels good that they're finally succeeding. And we use nurturing adults. That's the third really key component that makes our program very different. I make sure we only hire people that like kids, and I mean the kids that are hard to like sometimes. I make sure of it, from the secretaries to the people that answer the phones. Every single person in our center enjoy children, and they start the day afresh. When the kid messed up the day before, it's a new day the next day. And I think by surrounding our children with people rather than fences and walls, we provide the kind of care that really turn these children around and make them feel supported and cared about. It's also an excellent way to spend Oregon's dollars. We're a non-profit organization. We fundraise for our buildings. We do have a beautiful campus. We've gone out there and gotten a lot of money given to us to provide a beautiful campus, pretty buildings, nice surroundings for our kids. We use donations to help with our operational costs. We utilize volunteer services. And we jump through all the hoops that you have to jump through to become Medicaid eligible. We're a JACO facility. It's expensive to be a JACO facility, but it brings in $1.50 of federal funds for every dollar spent. And that is pretty huge. So it's the last way that we save Oregon a lot of money is we're preventative. You know, by treating children, we keep them out of the legal system. They don't abuse their kids like they've been abused because they got treatment. They don't need prisons built for them because they're successful, they have a job, they work. So I'm hoping that you and others, hopefully this will get passed on, and the next setting will also continue to support our services. We're running in a deficit year. We're $129,000 in the hole this year alone. We continue to provide free treatment services, because I know with this system change, it's a little slow to, you know, make those type of changes. It's not that I'm complaining, but in order to provide the community-based care that we are trying to promote in the new system changes, we need to be able to financially survive those changes. So I'm asking you to support our bill, Bill 604, and to support the money that goes with it. And thank you very much for your time.
What is your budget?
Our budget?
Mm-hmm.
Our budget is dependent upon how many kids we have. So it's over $2 million a year.
And
we
how many
treat over 200 children a year, though.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Question?
Yes,
Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much, and thank you for being here today to help us better understand the opportunity. What have been your experiences attracting highly qualified staff to work with your program? And then also, if you could talk about the cultural competence efforts that appear to be an internalized part of your program. If you could talk about the successes that you're having there with your with the population that you're serving.
Okay.
Could you mention the first grade number?
Attracting qualified staff.
Oh, we're very fortunate in attracting qualified staff. I mean, I think that working at a center that is so efficient and effective in turning children around, when they come in a mess, acting out, self-abusing, assaulting people, just the type of children they are, and to see them walk out the door with their head held high, they're complex children, and this might sound odd, but it's fun to treat kids and turn them around and see them succeed. These complex children, figuring out what you can do to help them on an individualized basis. And I'm sure David will speak for his own side of things. Dave's our medical director, and he helped build the program. It's just a fun, feel-good way to spend your time, and I think it's infectious. Other people want to work there as well, other docs, other professionals. So we don't have the turnaround that other people suffer.
All right.
Cultural competence.
Our cultural competence. We have about a third of our children are Native American. And, of course, we don't, you know, we take all types of minority groups, but that just happens to be a minority group that in our center isn't much of a minority. So we have a cultural coordinator, Vincent Bruning. He's an Oxford graduate. He's got a couple of master's degrees and a licensed therapist. He runs our cultural program for all cultures in our center. His primary interest, being Native American himself, is the Native American child. And he has prayer groups in his teepee, a teepee that we've constructed and have outside of our center. It holds about 20 people. It's quite a huge teepee. But he has these groups in the morning from 8 to 8:30, and children, it's really a character development type of program, and the kids talk about bravery, respect for others, traditions, just different types of topics each week, and they pass sage, which is part of the culture, and it's a highly respected part of the program from the kids' perspective. We have a lot of involvement from all of our kids. No kid is excluded from that. And I think they all gain from that experience of going. And it's not a required group, so they can come and go and attend once every 2 weeks or every time it's offered. It's really up to the child. And, in fact, we try to give our kids a lot of control over those types of decisions. We also have a traditional sweat lodge built on a campus. And, you know, there's certain ways it has to be built. It's bent willows, and that have to be collected in a certain way and constructed. And, you know, I'm all for building permanent, nice-looking structures, and Vincent's like, no, that's not how you do it. I mean, he's very clear that, you know, you don't get to put teak on their willow branches. And he's a neat guy, and he runs a good cultural program, and we're very, very lucky to have him.
We have about 15 minutes to go, so I want to make sure everyone can get to testify on this.
Okay. Well, let me introduce myself. My name is Dr. David Conant Norville. I'm a child and adolescent psychiatrist. I practice in Beaverton, Oregon. I'm a native Oregonian. I've lived here essentially all my life. When I leave, I come back, and I can't imagine a nicer place to live. I'm also currently the president of the Oregon Council for Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. I am the medical director at Pendleton Academies, and I've been the medical director since we developed the program. I was the first child psychiatrist to move out to Eastern Oregon when I moved there in 1987 and lived there for 6 years until family obligations required me to return to Portland, where I have family. But I continue to go to Pendleton, and partly because I like the community. I think we've developed a great program. It's a good model. It's a model that I think can be duplicated in other places once we write our book. And it's a model that's predicated on the importance of the family in a child's life. Now, many of the children don't have a family, and they're very ill, and their families are very ill. So we take those kids into residential treatment. Mary's talked a lot about that. Now, one of the problems that I noticed when I was in Pendleton as a child psychiatrist, and now I go there two or three times a month, fly in. I'm on video conference at least two or three times a week to Pendleton for clinical cases, it is that there never has been a day treatment program there. When I got there, I said, so where's the day treatment program? I've essentially done everything. I've worked at the Indian Reservation. I worked at Umatilla County Mental Health. Right now, I do one day a week at LifeWorks Northwest, taking care of kids. I don't need to do that, but I do that because that's part of the responsibility. And I have a very busy outpatient practice, and in fact, we have the biggest child psychiatric practice in the state in Wine Manors, BC. But the focus here is, how do you provide good quality community-based care? Now, we can set up a residential treatment program for folks around the state, and I think we do a great job. I always talk about taking kids from Washington County and sending them to Pendleton. It's like going to the far side of the moon. They really learn to change, and they don't have to get into the same habits they've had in the past. But for kids in the local community, there really has not been a high level of community-based care where they could stay with their family. Since we have many kids that are referred from our area, and since we try to be family-focused, we sometimes the kids live in other families until their families can get healthy, and then we try to return them back to the home community. Now, often that works, but one of the difficulties is, how do you get kids into a good school program? Occasionally they can work into a special education program, but often the kids have such severe psychiatric illness and the family has such severe needs that they need a special program that is very professionally focused. Now, the difference between day treatment and just, you know, a special ed program is essentially professional services and teamwork. What we have at Pendleton Academy is a well-established team. Not only am I a child psychiatrist that flies in there and is on video conference, we have two other very senior child psychiatrists that I've recruited to come out and work at equal level to me. So we basically split up the caseload three ways. We take, you know, these are our kids, these are our patients, and we want to take care of them. It's a little different than other day treatment programs around the state, where child psychiatrists may consult, may take care of some kids, but may leave out other kids to receive community-based care. We really want to have a collaborative, coordinated treatment effort with the kids that are in our program. And this includes their families. Now, if kids can go home, or if kids are doing okay at home, but not doing okay in school and the community and have severe health problems, these are the kind of kids that would come into our program. We may prevent residential treatment, or we may help get kids transitioned home and continue their care while they're at home. And for the kids in Umatilla County, this is really a great opportunity. You know, to some extent, you guys have an option here. But to me, it's do we buy or do we build? And, you know, build is, oh, well, let's just sort of, like, let it all sit out, and we'll just sort of take bids and see who wants to come up with the lowest bid, and they'll do it. Or do you buy the program that's established and efficient and has all of the professional support services, including locally based psychologists, who I think are wonderful, nurses, nurse practitioners, psychiatrists, special education teachers, that are all in a coordinated and complete package. That's it. Thanks.
Thank you. Glenda Baker?
Becker. Becker. Madam Chair, Senators and Representatives, I have been with Pendleton Academies since the beginning. And I've been therapeutic foster family.
Please introduce yourself.
Glenna Becker, and I'm affiliated with Pendleton Academies and have been, and I'm also a foster, therapeutic foster home.
Okay.
And I'm a kid person, and I'm very nervous right now. You give me a room full of kids, and I'd be much calmer. But I, like I said, I've been a foster parent for going on 18 years. We've been with, we've had probably, oh my goodness, I'm sure it's up in the area of 200 kids have been through my husband's and my home. Some of them, the youngest is 7. The oldest one just turned 18. And currently we have 2 children in our home. And one of them is day treatment. And I think what makes it so unique is over the years I've heard the term wraparound services for so long. And that's one thing I can't express it more, is if you have a school and psychiatric help for these kids, you have a weekly meeting, and so all of these elements, that's wraparound. When you have all of these elements that are working together for success of these kids, you've got it. You're going to have a child that maybe went through the system that might be sitting right next to you. You know, you have to take care of all of the elements, not just one. Because success, I mean, it's taken some of these kids years to develop their survival skills, and they're not healthy, but that's how they survive. So you're not going to extinguish that just if you treat one element. And the biggest reward that my husband and I have is our big phone bill when the kids call home and say, well, we're doing good. I now have a trucking business. And that's the rewards for all of this. But I just really impress upon you, you know, we need to treat all of the elements. Thank you for listening.
I want to thank you so much.
Yes.
People like you are gems, and we need to protect you and provide for you, too. It's so wonderful. There are not many people that have much patience with the mentally ill. And they can survive and become survivors and be great, productive citizens. And it's people like you that can make that possible. So thank you so very much. I'd like to call one more person up first, and then we can ask the panel any questions that you might have. Kevin Campbell.
Do you want us to...
Yeah, just sit back, and then if they have questions, we'll ask you to come forward.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the CEO of Greater Oregon Behavioral Health Incorporated and the coordinator of Eastern Oregon Human Services Consortium. First of all, I really appreciate the efforts of Pendleton Academy for bringing this piece of legislation forward, as well as the numerous co-sponsors of this legislation. I think it calls to point a great inequity in the children's mental health system as it stands today. All of you are aware of the changes that the children's mental health system has gone through, beginning with a budget note 2 sessions ago and intensive service array that we now deal with, and trying to move the care of these children into a managed care environment. GOBI prides itself in trying to do more with less money, but there are limits to what you can do with less money. When the Children's Systems Change Initiative was funded, there was a disproportionate sharing of day treatment dollars about the state. And in the GOBI 12-county region, there were only 10 beds of day treatment, 10.3 beds of day treatment allocated to all of our 12-county region. Those beds are in La Grande with Grand Ron Child Center. As most of you are aware, day treatment has been around since the 1970s, and the way for funding day treatment has been, just as you're looking at this bill, through legislation to create more day treatment slots around the state. The system has changed. The system has moved from what we have traditionally thought it to be to what it is today. And it, as Mary said, it is certainly in a state of flux and a state of transition. We're moving toward a continuum of care and a system of care. What I handed you is, Glenna referred to wraparound services. This is a good model of what wraparound services look like. Unfortunately, this model was developed with a federal grant of more than $1 million a year to a four-county region in the Mid-Columbia region. For those of us that are trying to put together a similar model on a far smaller budget than that, it is extremely difficult to get a continuum of care established in rural communities. For your information, Umatilla County is 28% of Gobi's population. Gobi has a total enrollment of about 29,000 members on any given month. So 28% of those members live in Umatilla County. Our annual budget, too, is about $10 million. We are a managed care company. We have a long and productive history of working with Pendleton Academy, both Gobi and EOSH. We've worked with them for all 10 years, 11 years now that I've been involved with EOSH, and 5 years with Gobi. We really admire what they do. We think they have a great deal of expertise. We think that they have been willing partners in moving the system forward, and we look forward to moving, working with them, and we need them in our region. We need them very much. We recognize that day treatment is a missing piece of the continuum of care in not only Umatilla County, but all of Eastern Oregon. We also recognize, Dr. Connett Norville talked about the similarities between day treatment and special education. One of the major dissimilarities is the setting. We recognize that we need to move more towards school-based services and less toward facilities-based services. We have begun this effort with Grand Ron Child Center. We're looking at the Child Center in Lane County as a model. We've met with Bill Willard and the rest of his staff on site. And we believe that more children can be served in a school-based setting through collaboration between schools, the managed care company, the community mental health program, and, most importantly, providers of intensive service array services such as Pendleton Academies can offer or Grand Ron can currently offer. The only major change that I would ask you to make to this legislation is, or to consider, a direct appropriation to Pendleton Academies is the way things have always been done in the past. I believe that has changed with this most recent children's initiative, and the appropriation should go to the Department of Human Services, and the money should go through the normal systems that would go to enhance day treatment capacity or other integrated service array services to the region, which would be Gobi in this particular case. As I said before, we have a good relationship with Pendleton Academy. Just before coming up here, Mary said we will share, and I said yes, we will share. I believe that rather than creating an anomaly, which goes back to a direct funding of a single provider for a specified service, we have to have faith in the way the system has changed, and we have to move it through the current distribution formula. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there questions?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Gordley and then Senator Carter.
I'll defer to Senator Carter.
Mr.
Campbell, can you tell us in terms of how much does it cost you on an average per day for your work with children, say, given the same kind of kids that Pendleton Academies provide services for?
It can be anywhere from $800 a day to $1,000 a day in an acute hospital setting. And they've been an excellent resource of helping us prevent that level of care. Gobi has some of the lowest acute care costs in the state of Oregon, and it's for the very reason that organizations like this exist and we're able to take care of kids at a lower level of care rather than having them need to go, in our case, to a Portland hospital or a hospital in Boise. On the other end of the spectrum, psychiatric day treatment services, Pendleton Academy has been very progressive with us to work with a rate schedule that is a little bit higher on day 1 through 3 because that's when the costs really happen, and yet after 60 to 90 days drops down to that. A statewide standard for that level of care is somewhere between $260 and $300 a day. Day treatment, on the other hand, runs in the range of about $150 a day. And as I said before, if we can move to a therapeutic classroom type setting, our goal is not to reduce that cost. Our goal is to serve more children in the community who may not rise to the need of a facility-based program.
Follow up.
Yes.
What is... Madam Chair, will you forgive me for acting like a Ways and Means person on this committee?
You are. We can never get that out of you.
I'm a numbers person. So.
Can you tell me what's the state portion? Let's use the number 800. What would be the state's portion of that versus the federal government's portion of that?
Senator Carter, as I understand the question as you're asking it, match would normally be a 60% federal money, 40% state money. The difference here is not that not all children who go into day treatment would be categorically eligible to be Medicaid, as you'd see in a PRTS level of care.
Okay.
So there could be children who... don't have any coverage at all that would need that level of service
right. That
only a general...
But if we take in consideration that the kid qualifies for the state, for the federal,
yes.
It would be a 60-40 match.
Approximately.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, Senator Gordon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Campbell, you cited the need for more school-based services, and I'm assuming that you mean in the 12 easternmost counties... in Oregon?
The Gobi catchment region is 10 counties in eastern Oregon plus Clatsop and Columbia counties. And we need school-based services. I'm Dr. Conant Norville, spoke of being a native Oregonian. I'm a native eastern Oregonian. I graduated with a class of 12 and in a town called Monument, Oregon, and I can guarantee you there are towns of that size that are in dire need of school-based services as mm-hmm. well. And I was in the top 25% of my class. Mm-hmm. So.
I love it.
If I may follow up, Madam Chair, does the workforce exist, or would a workforce have to be recruited to serve the need that you are describing?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I believe the workforce does exist, but I do think it takes the technical assistance of workforces such as Pendleton Academy has to coordinate these efforts in conjunction with community mental health programs. There's a great deal of skills training that can go on. There's in-home supports. There's a lot that we can learn from the developmental disability system in how we provide individual treatment plans and home-based services and school-based services. But we desperately need to maintain the brain power, if you will, of organizations such as Pendleton Academy or Grand Ron Child Center in our cases.
And so there is untapped potential.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right. No further questions? All right. I'd like to call Gina Nickel up and Becky Child. And just for the audience, the next bill we're going to do is 651. Because if we run out of time, 2312A and 2313A can be, we'll try to do them next Monday if we can't get them tonight. Okay, Gina?
Chair Mona Sanderson, committee members, for the record, my name is Gina Nickel. I'm the executive director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. And we are neutral on this bill, but we could be supportive with amendments, and I want to explain a little bit about that. We really want to thank Pendleton Academies and the representatives and the senators for bringing this issue to light, and that's one of children's mental health. We are very underfunded as a system. The Children's System Change Initiative process that we've gone through has really gotten off the ground. It's on the right foot. I hear great things about the Children's System Change Initiative, and we're working with the psychiatric day treatment folks and all the people that provide these services. I think this is really, this bill is a symptom of what's happening in the system. We're planning, everybody says we're going the right way, but there's just not enough money to take care of all the kids that we need to take care of. So what I would suggest is not only that you run the money through DHS, but that you put more money in it and recognize not only Pendleton Academies, but all of the services that are working in Eastern Oregon that are underfunded. And I think that's the conversation that we ought to have. I'm not sure that it's good public policy to fund just one private business, but you need to take a look at what they're bringing to the table, pointing out the need in all of Eastern Oregon, as well as the whole state of Oregon in the children's system.
Thank you. Questions?
Yes. Doctor, can you tell me how much in the last 5 years that the state has invested in children's mental health?
I don't have that number on the top of my head, but I can certainly get you that number.
And the reason I'm asking that question, colleagues, because Dr. Nickel and I have worked and wanted to see children's mental health go much further than it has gone in the last 10 years, let alone the last 5 years. And I think it is so, has been so woefully neglected. That's why you find the Pendleton Academies coming in and asking for money as an individual group as opposed to a joint statewide group on mental health, because we have, as a state, fail to pay attention to those who are most vulnerable in our society, not just our children, but our adult mental health program. And somewhere along the line, we have to have the willpower to be able to do a much more effective job in helping the people who have given their lives for making a difference. I see Dr. Conan Noble, who is as young as he is, spread out all of these different places, Beaverton, Oregon, Pendleton, Oregon, and it should tell us something. It should serve notice to us that not only is the workforce not there, but those that are there, if this man lived to be 60, I'd be surprised, simply because he's giving his life to doing this kind of stuff. And I don't mean that in a negative sense. I mean, in terms of his dedication, you just simply get worn out. I'm not projecting this, doctor. It's just trying to reach us as a state to know the importance of us being able to do at least the basic infrastructure. We're not even doing the basic infrastructure of care for the mentally ill, and certainly not our children. Yet we look forward to them as our future, but we're not doing anything to guarantee them healthy lives. And so I'm hoping that we will listen well, and that I will certainly be looking for these kind of issues with some resolution in the Ways and Means area.
Madam Chair, I don't think that should be used as on the recruitment tape for providers. But
I promise, doctor, it's not a forecast.
Good morning, Chair Monis Anderson and fellow committee members. My name is Becky Child. I'm the president of the Mental Health Association of Oregon. And, however, I'm not speaking on behalf of the Mental Health Association of Oregon this morning because I haven't had a chance to talk this over with my board yet. But individually, I am opposed to this legislation, not because the folks at Pendleton Academies are not doing good work, but because I believe that we need to have integrated services, and people need to be served in their communities, in their homes, in their schools, in the case of youth. And I'm encouraged to hear people talking about wraparound services and school-based supports. And I would encourage you that whatever you do with this legislation, that you look at integrating that into places where kids already are. Keeping them somehow segregated away from the community is still segregation. And when I talk with people who use services and from youth to adults to older adults, there's a lot of stigma associated with being in a going to someplace special. Even in special ed, I'm a former special ed teacher. I taught kids with emotional problems for 2 years in a self-contained classroom. And kids have difficulty being segregated away. That doesn't mean that there's not ways to support them, and you have to be creative, and there are other methods that can be used. And I just would encourage you to look at that when you're looking at this bill. And thank you.
Thank you. Question? Okay. Bob Nickel.
Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Bob Nickel. I'm Assistant Director for the Department of Human Services, and I'm responsible for the Addictions and Mental Health Division. I'm here to testify for a combination of reasons in opposition to this bill. Many of the arguments and reasons have been brought up. I want to say before I get into that just briefly that I've been to Pendleton Academies. I have a world of respect for Mary and the staff and the work that they're doing, and I'm pleased that this discussion has taken place too, because I think this illustrates one of many programs that are driven by the heart and the head in terms of knowledge and skills and a motivation to do the right things for kids. The concerns that I have about the bill are really that it's, you know, there are needs in many parts of the state for the same kind of set of services, and I just have great reservations about this not being an equitable way of going about that. I think a more planned process, a more statewide perspective, which I by definition have to have, would say we have needs in this area, but not, I'm greatly concerned about just targeting one program after another in order to do this. It's just not a systematic way of doing this. The one point that I don't think has come out very clearly is that the area where we're really struggling the most, in my opinion, in the children's mental health area as well as in the adult area, is services to kids and adults who are non-Medicaid eligible. We've had virtually no increases in that area. We put a little bit of state general fund money into the kids system to help with coordination of care when we closed the children's unit at the state hospital. But other than that, we've had a rough time as a state. I understand that over the last 5 to 6 years, but we have dramatically underinvested in kids services and adult services for those working class families, frankly, who are not Medicaid eligible. They just make too much, or they're not disabled, and yet they have the same kind of mental health needs as everybody else does. So for those reasons, and the fact that technically this is not in the governor's recommended budget, I have to reluctantly testify in opposition, but would hope that this raises the kind of issues that we've talked about this morning. So thank you for your
questions.
One?
Yes.
How much has been allocated for children's mental health this year in the governor's budget?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I'll have to go back and look at that. We'll certainly have that for the Ways and Means Committee. I don't have the number off the top of my head, but I can get it for you well before March 14th when I start testifying.
Good. And follow-up, ma'am?
Yes.
And if we were to look at a program of this nature and we follow the state's direction in terms of a system of care, which I personally believe in as well, how would you support a Gobi and a Pendleton Academies? Is there a formulary that you use for doing that, or how do you do it?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, the way rate setting is done in the mental health Medicaid managed care area, it's done on the basis of encounter codes that are quantified in terms of the value of the services. And that's a whole area that we've been working on, and I think we have a ways to go to make sure that that's adequate to sustain the very good conceptual changes and program changes that have started with the Children's System Change Initiative. So the quick answer is, in the Medicaid managed care population, it's a rate-setting process based, unfortunately, too much on history. And one of the things that I've been advocating for is that we look at more policy considerations in that process to look more at what the real need is and where we really want to be, not where we've been. I think Mr. Campbell has said it very well a number of times in meetings. We're doing this looking through the rearview mirror, mm-hmm. and I think we have to look at what we can legitimately get approved through the actuarial process and make sure that it will ultimately be a sustainable system change. In the other area for non-Medicaid eligible kids and families, I think there we have to look at epidemiological studies. What is the incidence of the various kinds of
children's mental health disorders, what are the recommended model programs for doing that, and then costing those services out. So I believe a more rational, equitable, and geographically considered process is what we need. And if funds were allocated to the department, those are my initial thoughts about how we'd go about this.
Gotcha. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Manager Cruz?
Yeah, thank you. And just a quick follow-up on what Bob just said. That sort of approach for the Medicaid population would be better as well. You know, we're bureaucracy-driven rather than need-driven to a large degree. Not your fault. It's just the way the system is. So, and I also wanted to say I agree with Bob that I mean, his perspective is you got to look statewide. I mentioned that earlier. We have needs statewide, and I'm hoping we do a better job of addressing. This is the need is here. There's no question about it. But I look at all the other day treatment facilities around the state, and the need is there as well. And so that needs to be addressed. And Madam Chair, I just want to thank you for bringing forward a bill that would get the nickels on different sides of an issue. So.
Okay.
Just one brief question, Mr. Nickel. Taking into consideration the consultant's report, the mental health master plan, and given everything you've said about the need for a system-wide approach, looking at all the needs in the state, with that said, so where might this piece fit, and at what point in time can you forecast us getting to this piece?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, the master plan focuses on the state hospital, and because we have had a long-standing policy direction, which we finally accomplished, which was to get all kids and adolescents out of the state hospital, the focus in the community services work group report, which I hope will be released later this week. That's my hope.
And committee, I sorry to interrupt, but starting March 21st, is it March 21st, that we're going to start with the mental health, the master plan, and then have two sessions on the community mental health piece. So we'll, and okay.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, just to finish the follow-up here, I think for the kids' non-Medicaid needs, I think we probably need to take a separate look at that from what we've done with community services work group, but we'd be pleased if we had an opportunity to do that.
Okay. And committee, what I'd like to do with this bill first, I would like to ask Ms. Nickel and Mary to look at some amendments, see if there's any agreement there with having funding going through DHS number one. And then I would like to not move this bill until after we have our mental health series, so we have a big, broader picture of how this fits in with all the other mental health. I had my staff figure out we have over 200 mental health bills up, and I'm not sure how many we're going to be able to address. But at least we're going to pick and choose, and this is really one of those priority ones because you have such a well-run program, and it's a model for the rest of the state, I'm sure. So with that, any other further discussion? Okay, I would like to close the public hearing on 604, and I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 651. And Jean Durfler, please. Lisa Lewis, John Bennett, well, Lisa Lewis and whoever you are.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I am Jean Durfler, and I'm a recovering politician, you might know, and I appreciate the opportunity to be able to come and talk to you today about a less important bill, perhaps, than what you've been just listening to. But I'd like to tell you, first of all, what the bill does. It's a fairly simple bill, and it requires that when a provider is paid, that the check has both names, the provider and the patient's name, on the check. And talk a little bit about the real world. It's a fairly simple bill, but pretty important to, I think, a lot of businesses and people in the state. In the real world, what happens is the doctor makes a determination that a procedure is needed. As an example, an MIR, a CAT scan, or something like in that manner. And the doctor usually recommends a place that they could have this done. Based on their experience, if they found some providers that will do a better service or are more cooperative and work better with the doctor. And sometimes the patient also has an opportunity of choosing where they wish to go. So it is open for people to choose what they want to do. After the procedure is done, the provider submits an invoice to the healthcare company. And in some cases, the check comes back to the patient. And what happens in many of those cases is that the patient has the check, cashes it, and doesn't pay the provider. So it makes it very difficult for the person providing those services to collect that money. And it's really difficult, in my opinion, for the person who doesn't pay the bill, because it really disturbs their credit ratings. And in the future, perhaps when they go down to try to buy a car or buy a house, they find that their credit rating is such that they have to pay a higher rate for a house, or maybe can't even purchase a car. So it is a difficult thing for the patient as well. Again, what this bill does, it provides that when that check is written, that both names are on, so that the patient can't cash it without both signing it. So I think it protects the patient. You know, when I came home to service in 46, I worked for a very large corporation, and in the training programs that I received, I was told, and I think it's true because it's substantiated, that 6 out of 10 people will steal if they have the opportunity. They'll steal from you. And the responsibility of a company is to make sure that those opportunities don't arise. In other words, you remove the possibility of people being dishonest. And I think we all have that obligation to make sure that those things are removed, that the temptations aren't there for people. And that's what this bill would do. I think it really hurts the patient in the future as well as the provider. The other thing is that this is presently, it's not something new. In other states, this already takes place. The providers do pay giving two checks. We're getting both names on the check so that this doesn't happen. So, again, it's not something new. It is done in other states, and I think that it's not that difficult if they find they can do it in some states where they can't do it in this state.
Yes.
Sure.
I thought that happens right now. I mean, I just had surgery, and when the check came for... to me, my doctor's name was on it. I just had to sign it and pass it on,
mm-hmm.
so they could sign. I thought that was automatically done as opposed to procedurally.
I think in many cases that is done, but in some cases the insurance companies don't do it, and so that's why we are trying to introduce this bill to make sure that that is done.
Well, it certainly makes sense to me.
Okay. Also, if you will notice that I have passed out to you an amendment, and the reason that the amendment is there because there was some question about the original bill, how it was written, because it said shall, and in some cases it may be interpreted that they shall pay the bill whether the service was done or not. So just to clarify it, we'd made it sure that if the bill is paid, then the check should have both names on it. So I think it's important that this bill passes. First of all, I think you have an obligation, as well as the companies, to make sure that temptations aren't there for people to be dishonest. So I think that's one of the big things. I think it helps small businesses, because I've heard from many people that have businesses that this has happened to them. In fact, I was talking to Senator from Medford, who is a doctor, and this has happened to him a time or two, and he's aware of this type of thing happening. It's already being done in other states, And are we less important in Oregon than we are in the state of Washington or California? So I think for those reasons, this is a good bill, and it does help people, the patients as well as the providers. So for that reason, I would hope that this bill could be passed.
Just one question. Do you know if it's a mandate in other states?
I know in the state of Washington, there is a bill written that requires them to pay for, put both names on the check.
Okay. But at this point, there's nothing in statute that you're aware of?
In Oregon?
In Washington?
Yes, there are statutes requiring.
In Washington. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Perhaps with that, let John talk a little bit about his experience.
My name, Madam Chair and fellow members of the committee, my name is John Bennett. I'm with Willamette Open Imaging, a provider of imaging services here in Salem. And when Gina and myself first looked at this, what I did is I actually went to the Washington law, because I've had healthcare businesses in Washington. So I said, let's just, instead of recreating something, let's just duplicate what's in Washington to try and bring to order. And that's exactly what we did. And Senator Carter, you're correct. And some insurance companies will write a check to the patient and the provider of the services, where since it's not mandated here in Oregon, others don't. They'll just write it directly to the patient. And a typical example is last week we had a patient that received a $1,500 check from an insurance company, and we called them to find out where the check was, and she said she spent it. At least she was honest. So what happens now is we go through the file, we send the letters for like 60 days. If we don't collect the money, we have a choice to turn it over to a collection agency or pursue it in small claims court. So
it's cost to the business. Oh, I'm so sorry.
You're correct, Senator Carter. That's exactly what happens. And I know the insurance companies. We met with one insurance company. They gave us two reasons. One is they wanted to be able to control cost, and two is the software. And I sort of sat back, and I appreciate that. I was an internal auditor with Cigna in California and audited their health plans for a couple of years. And I sat back, and I sort of scratched my head, and I thought, wait a second. They control what they reimburse us, whether we're contracted or not. We have no control over that. And the software issue, when those insurance companies pay for patients that get services across the border in Vancouver, what's the problem with the software? So, again, they choose to, whether you're contracted or non-contracted, they chose not to contract with us because they said, we already have enough services in the area. We said, that's fine. So, again, all we're trying to do with this is just sort of simplify the law and make it very easy for Oregon and Washington will all be the same. So, thank you.
All right. Thank you.
This is Lisa.
Hi, Madam Chairman, Committee. Thank you. My name is Lisa Lewis, and I'm here in support of the bill as a small business medical provider. Just to offer up that it removes the temptation from the patient who receives a check, and they have other expenses. It's Christmas time and everything like that, and it's very easy to take the check to the bank and think, oh, I'll pay the medical provider in the future. And for small medical providers, they need that money to pay their employees and keep the doors open mm-hmm. so that they can provide services to the other patients. And as Senator Carter experienced, she got the check with both of them. You immediately turned it over to the provider and everything like that. And we're just asking that this bill be passed for those reasons.
As you know, you probably don't know. I've been working on cost containment issues last session, and I will be sponsoring a certificate of need bill this session. And imaging is one of those commodities, I say, that the public loves, and therefore the business sees that they can make a lot of money at it. And I think the insurance, one of the cost containments is we're trying to look at containing the costs within a city. I know that the doctor down in our esteemed doctor down there said there's so many MRI machines that are not necessary down in the Ashland Medford area. And so I think that's one of the issues that we as a committee need to look at in cost containment. So I'm going to, once I get my certificate of need bill through and see what happens with that, that is how I will look to see how this fits in with that concept. But I needed to get on the record that imaging is one of the reasons why we have such high health care costs. And somehow if we can contain that in some reasonable way, and I don't have the answer to that at this point in time. Any comment?
Madam Chairman, I'd like to recognize that we also believe in the UCR process and that there is a cost factored in, but the insurance companies have come up with a UCR, which is usual and customary, and that is the price that should be recognized, and that's the payment going toward the UCR versus the actual charges. So we are in agreement with you on that.
Okay.
But, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Just a question.
Yes.
My staff was here, so they didn't have the bill this morning to read. But then I hear two sets of things going on, because I thought this bill was about making sure that the temptation of people cashing a check before it comes to both people who are being paid versus an imaging issue. So it's a double bill? Is that what I'm hearing?
No, ma'am.
Not at all.
This is broad-based for any non-participating provider in the state of Oregon, that they would receive the check made out to the enrollee and the provider. It really has nothing to do with imaging. I was just commenting that we do agree with Senator Anderson that there does need to be cost containment.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm supporting her on this issue. Yeah.
But no, but this bill is strictly if the enrollee has non-preferred benefits.
Absolutely.
And they choose to go somewhere that is a non-preferred provider, that those checks are made out to both people. That's all this bill covers.
Okay.
And that's all it does.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. I'd like to call John Powell.
Thank you very much.
Yes, and thank you. Good to see you again.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Madam Chair and committee, this bill, as was described to you, is a simple bill. However, it incents an area that's not so simple. And it makes it very difficult for a group of people who are not involved in this every day to understand the broader implications of a policy like this. In Washington State, that has been mentioned, that has a law that requires insurers to pay some providers directly or with their name on the check, is in a system of a modified any willing provider law, which means each health insurer must provide categories of care and have them available for their enrollees. That means that in many cases they do not pay out-of-network providers at all. This bill would force insurance companies to make a decision to pay the providers directly or to go to an absolutely closed panel where they would not pay out-of-network providers. And let me give you the history of how we've dealt with this issue at Regents. And first I have to say that nothing that I say here is aimed at anything negative towards Mr. Durfler. As I told him before this hearing began, we were friends before this issue arose, and we're going to be friends after this issue. And I have all the respect in the world for him. When he brought this issue to my attention this last summer, I met with him and Mr. Bennett at their imaging machine and office. We then went to Portland and met with the vice president for contracting. After a discussion of the issues, Regents reexamined their market here in Salem, and they contract with 4 imaging companies in Salem. So the decision was made, as it would be in other markets, that we do not want to incent the development of unneeded technology. And for the Regents' book of business in this community, the 4 businesses that we contract, including Salem Hospital, meet the needs of our patients. So this bill would require us then to pay a contractor who's not contracted with us, either directly or put their name at the top of the check. So why is that a big deal to us? Let me hand you 2 documents. This first one is an article from the Chicago Tribune, dated February 11th of 2007. And I've highlighted one sentence in it on the 4th paragraph. And it simply says, U.S. doctors ordered more than 400 million imaging procedures, mostly MRIs, last year, up more than 40% from 218 million in the year 2000. This is an area that is exploding and continued to explode. And what does that have to do with pricing? As they explain, this just simply means we pay what we're going to pay these people. That's in the short term. But our other providers in the community who now lose patients to another machine have a higher cost per image than they did before if they're not getting that business. So, again, it sounds simple, but the long-term implications are much greater. What I'm handing you now is a series of newspaper articles from the Bend Bulletin newspaper, which chronicles a series of negotiations with the Bend Clinic last year. The demand for an increase of 30% in their fees, if applied statewide to all physicians, would have been $200 million increase a year. So,
how much?
$200 million. That's what a 30% increase in physician fees would mean just to Regents policyholders. This chronicles the negotiations that took place. We contract with 98% of the physicians in Oregon, and we want to contract with them because they're in short supply in many communities as opposed to being oversupplied. However, when we negotiated with them, the benefits of being a contractor and being paid directly and electronically and those sorts of things are one of the few negotiating items that we have as an insurer. And it was instrumental in bringing these people back to the table and getting a more reasonable compromise on fee increases. What this bill would do, again, would take some of that incentive and that negotiating power that we have away from us. So this bill, while being simple on the one hand, is much more complex in terms of the total cost of medicine in the future, both in Oregon and throughout the country. If the committee believes that this one particular imaging machine in Salem should be either on the panel of Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, or if you would incent us to just write joint checks, we wish the bill would be narrowed to that, because that's what the issue is in this particular instance, as opposed to applying it to every provider in the state of Oregon. Madam Chair, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Okay. Question? That may not solve President Derfler's
issue. Is that correct? If you narrowed it, Bill, to what?
Madam Chair, if this imaging machine that Mr. Dirfler is an owner of, if that is the issue the committee wants to address, we would prefer that the bill be narrowed to that situation. Because the dispute is over whether or not Regions chooses to contract with them and then how they pay if they don't. And again, if that is the issue, standalone, we would urge you to narrow it to that situation as opposed to apply it to all contracts throughout the state.
Further questions? I would advise you to see if that is acceptable to Mr. Dirfler. And any other comments? And then we will look to see what we do with this bill. All right? Yes.
I still don't think that gets to the issue of cost containment. Because if we are talking about, in the strict reality of cost containment, then if this company is not one of the providers that Blue Cross Blue Shield works with, then what we're doing is forcing Blue Cross Blue Shield to go out and negotiate with them. And I'm not sure we want to be a part of that kind of action legislatively. I just think it doesn't work well for public policy. But I agree with them in the initial phase that people should have to pay on the face value of services that were provided by a provider. But if the market trend is saying that we keep as much technology to a minimum in order to reserve the cost containment issue, and I think that becomes a different issue now. And I would prefer that the insurance company and that company work together to see if they can come to some kind of resolution. I would not want to pass judgment on that kind of legislation.
Well, I certainly don't want to get into changing negotiations. That's my issue on all of this.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 651, and I'd like to open a public hearing on 2312. Becky Child, is she the first one to speak on this? Or?
She may want to speak on both.
Yeah. And I might as well open a public hearing on 2313A2, because you're signed up for both of them, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Right, thank you. My name is Becky Child, Chairman of Sanderson, and again, I am the President of the Mental Health Association of Oregon. House Bill 2312, I believe, is what they're calling the fresh air bill, and I would like to have to say that I regret that we have to have a law to guarantee this right for people. I was one of the main instigators behind this bill because of doing advocacy for folks who were in the hospital in psychiatric wards. Some of the folks who I worked with really got direct benefit from being outside in fresh air. And the hospitals would tell me and tell them that there was no way that they could go outside to even feel the fresh air on their face. And some folks had been locked up in the hospital for 3 months. Most of these folks at that time were in acute care hospitals. And some of them were waiting to get to the state hospital. So I went to Bob Jundeff and asked. I said, can't we do something? Can we make a law? Because the only way that this is going to get changed, unfortunately, is if we put it in statute. And so that's why this bill is before you. And again, I'm really sad that we have to have a law to guarantee people access to fresh air who are having a difficult time in their lives. Also, it can be part of a wellness strategy. The other thing, as far as for 2313, the reason for that bill is because, I've talked with numbers of individuals who've been civilly committed who oppose their civil commitment but had no idea of how to oppose it or who to call if there was something that they thought had gone wrong. And when they are put on notice, then they get
a written notice of how to contact the Oregon Advocacy Center, where they can may be able to receive some assistance in seeing if there was injustice done. And the Mental Health Association supports this bill as well. And thank you very much.
Great. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How is fresh air and the outdoors defined?
I can't really answer that. Basically, it's just to get fresh air. I mean, it's subject to safety. I mean, I'm supporting of appropriate safety precautions. That's not a problem for me.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm not opposed to what this is attempting to do. My question at this point is who's defining, you know, especially the community-based settings where the outdoors may be a very limited factor if it's an urban sort of setting. And so I'm just wondering, and maybe Mr. Junedep can speak to this. I just want to make sure we're not creating something actionable here if it's beyond scope of a facility sort of thing. So
might as well call Bob Junedep also, and Bob Nickel might as well come too.
Madam Chair, serving on judiciary, it has kind of changed the way I look at things, and words have maybe more meaning than they used to for me. So,
well, I know the facilities in, or at least the prison in downtown Portland has slits for windows, and I have no idea where they would get their fresh air.
Madam Chair, my name is Bob Junedep. I'm director of Oregon Advocacy Center, and we're addressing two bills here today. On the bill having to do with people who are committed, those folks are generally in hospitals, and hospitals generally will have fenced-in areas because they're secure facilities in which people can go out and enjoy the outdoors without there being a danger of their eloping. For community facilities, these are, for the most part, non-locked facilities, and people in those facilities can go out whenever they want. As a general matter, the important factor is that they have appropriate supervision, if necessary, when they do go out. If there is a community facility that is locked, those facilities should have some capacity to allow a person to go outside. Now, that may mean that there would need to be staff supervision in order to keep that person safe, keep the community safe, and that's, in fact, why we had the Dash-1 amendments on the House side to assure that safety is taken into account when a person goes out of the facility. So there's a balance. There is no specific definition of what fresh air and out of doors means, but this was written in order to create a balance between and recognition that the person, as part of their living in a facility, that they should have the ability to go outside, and that right needs to be balanced against their safety and the safety of their community, and that's what we were seeking to achieve in writing it the way we did.
So, question then, how would the psychiatric hospital, absolutely, I see, you know, any other DHS facility, but how will we get into problems when we come to the correctional system?
Chair Montes-Anderson, this bill is specifically crafted to cover people who have been, well, there's two bills, one civilly committed,
yes,
and the other one is people who are receiving services from a community mental health or developmental disabilities agency. That's basically the county mental health agency. So people who are in the correction system are not going to be within that system.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Okay, and like I said, I don't have an objection to the intent here, but let's say, for example, I mean, you know, what is? I just want to make sure that you're in a group home. And you do have access to the outside, but it's in a town, and you don't have access to a park necessarily. And I just don't want somebody to come back and say they wouldn't take me to a park. And so, see what I'm saying?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I don't think there's anything in this bill that specifies an exact location in which a person needs to get their fresh air or out of doors. It's merely setting up an expectation that part of a long-term care arrangement for any individual with a severe disability will include an ability to be in the out-of-doors. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't specify exactly where in the out-of-doors, just that they have access to being outside of that building, and that that right to be outside of the building will be balanced against community and individual safety, so that we can basically send a message to providers and communities that if an individual is going to live in that setting in their community, that they should be able to go outside.
Okay, Madam Chair, having that on the record is helpful.
Yes,
so.
Thank you. Mr. Nickel.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, my name is Bob Nickel, Assistant Director for the Department of Human Services and Addictions and Mental Health Division. First of all, we're comfortable now with the bill as it's been amended, and we appreciate the work that Mr. June Depp and Ms. Child have done on bringing forward the bill to begin with and then working with us around the degree of flexibility that I thought we needed. As a runner for 32 years, it was really hard for me initially to testify in opposition to fresh air, so I'm personally relieved that we could do this. In response to Senator Cruz, your question about how we would define this, I think that where it's probably going to be the most challenging to define this operationally will be in the acute psychiatric units of our community hospitals. Mm-hmm. So what I would anticipate doing is working with Oregon Advocacy Center and the Oregon Inpatient Psychiatric Council to talk about this issue once the bill is hopefully passed, that we can sit down and talk about operationally what that means. You know, I can think of situations, particularly now in light of what we know about benzene levels in downtown Portland, that it may be that fresh air is fresher inside than outside.
We're going to need air purifiers for our outdoors. Okay, any further questions?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Just a comment. I want to thank Mr. June Depp and Becky Child, Bob Nickel. Thank you for working together to bring both of the bills forward. And to Becky Child in particular, thank you for your patience today. I know there was a little concern about whether you would actually have an opportunity to be heard today, and I know you came a distance, and we respect that. You did that, but also I just want to say how much I respect the work that you do every day on behalf of people who are living with so-called disabilities. And I'm learning a lot from you and the way in which you use your voice, not only in this process, but I'm also remembering your work around the mayor's mental health and public safety panel. So thank you. Thank you for what you do and the way you do it, and look forward to continuing to work with you.
Okay. With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on House Bill 2312A and open a work session on House Bill 2312A.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2312A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley moves House Bill 2312A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carter?
Aye.
Senator Gordley?
Excused.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Gordley?
Aye.
Chair Montes Anderson?
Aye. Motion pass. And Senator Gordley, would you?
Yes.
Carrie? Okay. I would like to close the work session on 2312A and open a work session on 2313A.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2313A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carter?
Aye.
Senator Courtney?
Excuse.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Gordley?
Aye.
Chair Montes?
Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Gordley, will you carry this one also? All right. I would like to close the work session on House Bill 2313A, and the meeting is adjourned.